Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome into RNIB Tech Talk, our weekly opportunity to catch up with the world of technology from a blindness and low vision perspective. Don't forget, of course, you can first hear Tech Talk right here on RNIB Connect Radio each Tuesday lunchtime at 1, Thursday evenings at 9, or Saturday tea time at 5. If you prefer a podcast, well, you know where to get that. Ask your smart speaker or smartphone to play the latest episode of RNIB Tech Talk. Of course, this programme would be nothing without you, so please do get in touch. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That's T-E-C-H-T-A-L-K @rnib.org.uk. Regular emails, voice notes, all very welcome. Coming up this week, we'll be finding out about Starship delivery robots and how they are impacting the lives of blind and partially sighted people. Paulina will be chatting with a man about accessible video gaming, and we'll be learning more about indoor navigation from Good Maps. Welcome in to our co-hosts, Hubert Pavarkovich and Callum Stoneman. Gentlemen, how are you?
All good, how are you?
Smash in, yeah, Callum?
Yeah, doing pretty well. Can't complain too much.
Alrighty. What's happening in your world? What's in your tech in tray? Hubert, let's come to you.
Well, I'm a bit late to the party on this, but I've discovered an interesting app. Has anyone heard of an app called Too Good To Go?
No.
No. Tumbleweed moment. You're going to have to tell us about it.
So basically, it's an app where you can... different kind of stores or restaurants, basically you can basically buy food for a lower price at the end of the day, where it's food they've not used but it's still very much edible, and you can actually pick it up and it can last you for still quite a few days. So it aims to end food waste, and it has recently been given a few accessibility improvements where you can actually finish the order. When you go to the store, previously you had to swipe in order to complete the order, which was not accessible and you had to do it without voiceover. They have now improved it so you can actually complete the whole process by double tapping on a button to reveal the code in the store when you come to collect your good-to-go bag. And it's quite fascinating what you can get depending on which store or restaurant or cafe you choose. So I'm a bit late to the party on this, apparently, because people have been using this. But yeah, that's my kind of late to the party discovery.
This sounds brilliant. So it's going to help with the cost of living, because presumably you can get food at a slightly lower price. It, like you say, it minimises food waste. Is this a London thing, though, Hubert, or are people going to be able to use this in other parts of the country, do you know?
You can use it anywhere in the country. I use it in my local area in Bedfordshire. I know people who use it in West Midlands and in London as well. So my impression is it's available pretty much anywhere.
Too Good To Go.
Yeah, I will say, now that you've mentioned it, I think I heard about it a few months ago and I just couldn't remember the name of it. Now you've explained what it is, I recognise it. And yeah, there's a few places around my area as well. There's a few places in around Bolton and Manchester that are participating. So I think it is. Obviously, you'd have to grab the app and put in your location. It will show you places nearby, I guess. But yeah, it does seem to be UK-wide, definitely.
Android version and iOS?
I believe it's available on both Android and iOS.
Excellent. Too Good To Go. Give it a go. Let us know what you think. Callum, what's happening with you?
There's a bit of a food theme going on this week, because we've got a new product announcement from Cobalt Systems. They've just announced a new talking air fryer, which sounds pretty interesting. I mean, it's strange, is this one, because I've always been quite dismissive of the talking microwaves, which is what Cobalt are quite known for. You know, I feel like if you're just blind or partially sighted, I would always say just buy the cheapest, most basic microwave you can, preferably with dials, or just make it accessible yourself. You know, get someone to help you put bump-ons on it. I would always say, you know, you don't really need to spend that money on a talking microwave. But actually, with the talking air fryer, I'm pretty excited about this. I don't think I'll buy one as such, because I've got my Ninja air fryer, which I'm quite comfortable using. But this is good. I mean, how often is that question coming up in a lot of the community kind of social media groups? You know, what air fryers are accessible? And I know, Dave, you've got one with good old dials, but I don't think there's many. I think a lot of them are menu-driven or touchscreen or even both.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, it might be not just what's the most basic accessible thing out there, right? It might be that you want to have the programs and the extra settings and the extra capabilities. Maybe you haven't got, you know, Alexa in your kitchen as a timer. So
yeah.
So maybe you want those built-in features to be accessible.
Yeah, and I am starting to learn the lesson about relying too much on smart devices because, you know, for example, I've got the Samsung washing machine that I've talked about before. But a couple of days ago, I went to put some washing in. I put some washing in, closed the door, put the smart control setting on the washing machine. But then there was a glitch for a couple of hours. Smart Things was down. And that literally meant that I couldn't turn on the washing machine.
So next time we see you, Callum, and if your clothes aren't clean, then we've got to blame the Smart Things service. Is that what you're telling me?
I'll blame the Smart Things app, yeah.
Oh, no.
But no, this sounds really good, this air fryer, because it's not just your basic air fryer either. They've only just announced this and it's available for pre-order at the minute. It's not in stock, so there's not a huge amount of info about it, but it says it speaks the times and temperatures. Apparently there's 5 presets as well for I don't have the exact list, but there's presets for like steak, fish, potatoes. It's not just a case of, you know, they've just taken a really basic air fryer and put speech into it. It seems quite full-featured by the sounds of it.
Hopefully we can get hands-on when it becomes available. I understand that they're taking pre-orders. And what do you think? Are you more kind of mainstream appliances, or do you actually look out to see if there are specialist talking appliances that might make life easier? Do let us know. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. Stick around. It's another Tech Talk. Imagine the scenario. There's somebody at the door or something at the door with your grocery shopping, and you open up to discover it's a delivery robot. This could happen. It is happening. And here to help us understand what this means for blind and partially sighted people is Lisa Johnson, who is the Director of Public Affairs at Starship Technologies. Welcome to RNIB Connect Radio, Lisa. Just so many questions. Where to start? Can you please, for us, just describe one of your Starship delivery robots? How big is it? How much does it weigh? How fast does it go? What should we expect?
Oh, I can indeed, David. It's wonderful to be here to talk to your listeners. So a Starship robot is kind of like a little cooler on wheels. It's got 6 wheels. It's a little white and black box that's got a load of sort of cameras and sensors inside it to help it drive autonomously. It's about 70 centimetres long. And then it's 57 centimetres wide and 57 centimetres tall. So it's kind of about the width of an average pedestrian and comes up to just above knee height. But it's also got a flag on there, and that's to help people who are partially sighted or maybe have low vision. And that comes up to about shoulder level. It's a black flagpole with a bright orange LED flag on it with LED lights inside it. And it weighs about 35 kilograms when it's unloaded. In terms of how fast it goes, it's kind of like a little cautious pedestrian. So it can go up to 4 miles per hour on the pavements, but usually it's going a little bit slower than that because it's a little cautious pedestrian who's always sensing what's around it. And if it sees there's an obstacle or someone coming along, it's going to slow down quite significantly.
And where are we likely to find your robots?
Well, so in the UK, we're actually operating at the moment across Milton Keynes and Northamptonshire, and some places in Bedfordshire, Cambridgeshire, Leeds, Wakefield, Trafford in Greater Manchester. So we've got quite an extensive UK operation, but we're also across the United States. We operate in Germany, Denmark, Estonia, and across the whole of Finland too.
Right. And you've sort of touched on some of this already, but just tell us a bit about the company and your mission, especially in the context of making sure that your robots are accessible and inclusive for blind and partially sighted customers.
This is really important to us because Starship's core mission is to make life easier and more convenient for people and businesses, and to do that in a sustainable and ethical way. So making sure that we do have an accessible solution, there's twofold really. It's that it's useful to people who have disabilities. So around a quarter of our customers tell us that they have a disability or live with someone who has a disability. So it's important to us to be an accessible solution, but also then being sensitive and accessible and inclusive in the way that we operate in communities. So that is really important to us. So, but in terms of us as a company, we operate in the countries that I've just outlined. We've traveled over 11 million kilometers globally, making more than 5 million deliveries. So every journey we do, we learn more. As you can imagine, having done that many journeys, traveled that many miles, we've learned a lot about what we do. So we're a really safe, autonomous, accessible and inclusive solution.
Right. And just talk us through some of the features that your robots have to make sure that they are safe and that they recognise the needs of pedestrians who might not be able to see them coming.
Yeah, so it's a really sophisticated sort of bit of technology we're talking about. So our robots inside them, they've got 12 cameras. They've also got time of flight cameras, which means that they can judge how quickly things are moving to and from and around them. They've got sensors and radar. So all the time, they're kind of, they've got a 360 view of the environment around them. So actually, they've got one up on pedestrians like that, because you and I don't have eyes in the back of our heads. So they're looking all the time around them to see what's happening. And because of that, they've got really sophisticated obstacle avoidance technology within them. They've got what we call neural networks. So that's how they learn. When I said we learn with every journey, every time they make a delivery, make a journey, these robots learn and figure out more about the world around them. And by doing that, we can then also modify their behavior in certain scenarios. So I'll take you through one, for example, with mobility devices. When we first started out, the robots hadn't encountered enough mobility devices, so they didn't know what one was. It takes a lot of encounters. And once you've had those encounters, you can say to the robot, hey, robot, if you meet somebody who's in a wheelchair, you should behave slightly differently than in just a normal situation. And so that's the sort of thing we work on continuously round the clock, year on year. So some of the things that we've done already, for example, that the flag design on our robot, it used to be a really pale yellow. And we spoke to the good folks at RNIB and said, what would you do to make this better? And they said, well, it's not going to stand out against a lot of backgrounds. So let's change that, which we did. So now it's got LED lights built into it to make it stand out better. In terms of guide dogs, we wanted to make sure that guide dogs interacted okay with our robots and our robots with guide dogs. So we conducted a few trials there as well. Very recently, we were speaking to people in Leeds around our Leeds launch and about the practicalities. So if the robots, during a day-to-day trip, the robot's making a delivery and it goes to traffic lights to cross, what's the best thing for us to do in that scenario? And so we actually changed what we did in terms of how the robots wait at traffic lights by making sure that the robot never parks next to where you would push the button to cross the lights. Through to things like just making sure that the robots aren't silent, that if there's a robot around you, you know that it's there.
So do they make a noise then? Is there a sort of a buzzing or beat? Do they, you know, what am I likely to hear?
Yeah, it's kind of a low-level hum.
Right.
Because we could make it completely silent. You know, our electric vehicles these days can be completely silent, but we choose not to do that. That is kind of the same scenario, really. We want to make sure you can hear the robot moving.
And does that cut through, like, in, you know, busy environments?
It does. And we can modify it. So we can make the robot a little bit louder if we need to.
Yeah. I'm just thinking, like, you know, if you're walking down a pavement on a, you know, busy afternoon, you know, lots of traffic perhaps, and maybe there's a delivery robot coming in the opposite direction and I'm there sort of, you know, tapping along with my cane. So you mentioned the field of view. So the robot's going to see me coming and presumably take, you know, evasive action. Will I be alerted to the presence of the robot in any way?
So it kind of depends on the scenario. And this actually ties into one of the things that we're really working on at the moment. So we've got what we call an accessibility advisory panel, where we kind of, the RNAB is involved in that, along with other charities like Leonard Cheshire, for example, and some academics. And so we take real world scenarios and then we come to you guys and say, what should we do in this scenario? And I feed that back into our engineering and our autonomous driving processes. So one of the most important thing is the robot's always going to try and avoid everything around it because that's what it's programmed to do. It's programmed to be cautious. It's programmed not to get close to people. So anything that we add on top of it is kind of belt and braces, additional stuff to make it even sort of more responsive. One of the key things we're working on at the moment is how the robot could recognize a cane and therefore how we could modify behavior based on that. So as you can imagine, a cane's, we all know, quite thin. If you're a robot trying to detect it, there's obviously not that many pixels there because it's quite thin. So we need to have thousands of interactions with a cane And as soon as we've got to that point, we're getting close now, we're doing some really good work on this. As soon as you've got to that point, when the robot understands what a cane is, then you can program it to behave better. Or as has been suggested by RNIB and others, to make an audible sound and announce its presence when it's there, which is something that we've done now with mobility devices. So if someone's, if a wheelchair and a robot are on a narrow path and they happen to get in each other's way, a little robot will recognize the mobility device and just say, hey guys, we're in a little tricky situation here. A human's gonna help me out in a second. Because that's important too. Our robots are always backed up by a remote assistant who's behind the scenes if the robot needs a little bit of help.
So those collaborations then with organisations and experts are really key. And you mentioned that you've got a sort of an advisory group that you work with. Just tell us a bit more about that. Is it always kind of reactive, or are you planning for other scenarios? How often do you meet?
We're meeting roughly sort of once a quarter, broadly. It's quite a new thing. It's one of those things where as a startup, you're sort of looking at, right, what's the best way to do this? And it's evolving over time. So there's accessibility advisor group on a national level where we tend to like look at, right, what's our engineering priorities? Are these the right priorities for us to be looking at as Starship? If we get to this point where we recognize certain objects around us, how would you as a community suggest our robot behave in that scenario? So that's quite proactive in terms of looking at and actually listening and practically influencing how we develop our robot behavior, which we think is the right approach. But then we've also got in the communities where we operate. So we don't just do the high level stuff where we're kind of like, oh, what should our big sort of global reaction to a certain scenario be? We also engage with local groups wherever we go, because our robots could be 100% perfect at all times. But obviously it's not just about the robot behavior, it's about interaction with humans and humans understanding how the robots are gonna behave too. So we do a lot of work on the ground before we go to any area. We don't kind of just go, hey guys, here's robots and that's it. We spend months in advance talking to people and sort of saying, hey guys, robots are coming. Here's what happens with them. Here's how it all works. Any questions? We'll go to deafblind groups. So we'll let people see, touch robots, listen to the robots, make sure they can feel them, the height, the size, the width, that sort of stuff, just so that people in the community are at least aware and understand a little bit about who we are before we get going.
Fantastic. Well, I'm very keen to have my first robot encounter at some point. We should definitely make that happen. Have you got any real-world examples of where the robots are making a difference in the lives of disabled people?
Absolutely, we do. Yeah, it's one of the lovely things when we do customer surveys, because we specifically started to ask about this sort of stuff so that we can create a pool of people that we can really talk to and get lived experience from. Because as you know, we can assume things as people who don't have sight loss or have full mobility, but it's never going to replace the lived experience. So we started to ask this in all of our customer experience surveys. And as I said earlier, around 25% of our customers have a disability or live with someone who does have a disability. So there's a whole range of stuff from, we've had people who've been more than one, there seems to be a lot of kidney transplant users of our service who said, well, I couldn't go out for a sustained period of time because I had to shield inside because my immune system was compromised. It was really great that the robots could bring me stuff during that time. And we had a segment on the One Show quite recently with a resident in Trafford who uses a mobility device to get around. And she said, look, I can get out to the shops, but for me, it's just a bit more complicated. It takes me much longer to go out to the shops. When there's no minimum delivery value, I can get my groceries delivered quite quickly and cheaply if I just get a Starship robot instead. So that was really nice to see. But the other one, we've got some experience in, and we don't fully understand it yet, is that neurodivergent children seem to really, really value and love the robots. And there's a level of interaction there that's just really nice to see. So we're going to do a little bit more looking into that in terms of like, what is it about our robots that kids with neurodivergent conditions are especially taken to? But it's very cute. I will say, when we see the kids dressing up Halloween, for example, as Starship robots.
And have you received any specific feedback from blind and partially sighted people about about their experiences with your autonomous delivery robots?
Yeah, we have. And, you know, it would be really easy for me to come on here, wouldn't it? And just be like, yeah, it's all great. There's never any problems. But, you know, we all know that when you're developing technology like this, it's not necessarily going to be perfect from day one. So I think some of the conversations that we've had with people who are blind and partially sighted, It's actually about in advance reassurance and understanding, because if you're partially sighted and you're used to taking a certain route with your cane or your guide dog on a certain day, then all of a sudden you would think there are going to be five or six robots in a convoy rolling down your pavement. I can see why you might be concerned about that. But the reality is you might see one robot a day, if that, because you know you have a small fleet of robots delivering groceries. They're not all on the same street at any given time. And it's not kind of a case of, oh, the robots are coming and they're taking over. There's going to be sort of 10 robots in an area scurrying about delivering shopping that they're not going to take over. So a bunch of it is kind of that reassurance in advance that it'll be okay, and making sure people can understand exactly what's going to happen. But some of the practical feedback stuff. So we've been working with the American Foundation for the Blind around how do you make sure that a robot delivery arrives exactly the same place every time you order it for somebody who is blind. That's been one of the needs that we've sort of been asked about. And we're trying to figure that one out, because our robots will go to exactly where you've dropped a pin on a map or to your exact address, but it could be within like, you know, a margin, or you might drop the pin in a slightly different place every time.
Yeah, it's like the what three words thing, isn't it? You know, you sort of want it in that meter square, because not even human deliveries do that. You know, I've had parcels left in all sorts of weird and wonderful places. You know, one of my favourites was somebody wedged something in the top of the wooden porch that overhangs our front door. And of course, as a blind person, I had absolutely no idea. I was walking, you know, backwards and forwards looking for this parcel, and it was above my head.
Well, that's one thing our robots won't do. They're not going to be able to reach that high. But I did kind of say as well, look, we're trying to provide a really positive experience, but we're not going to be a solution for every single aspect of life. So people say, can the robots get upstairs if you're in a flat? Sadly, they've not developed a Dalek-style flotation yet. So until we get to that point, people do have to come and meet the robots at the gate. So, you know, we've not got every single avenue of logistics covered as it is yet. But, you know, I think we are providing quite an accessible solution in that way.
And is that the sort of the next thing then? I mean, are you able to kind of tease us with some of the stuff that you're working on? Is it that being a bit more precise about where it arrives or drops off? Is that the sort of the next kind of frontier, or are there other things we should be looking forward to?
I mean, definitely in terms of, yeah, the actual delivery and making sure that blind people can access our deliveries as effectively as possible. Absolutely. But then I think for me, it is the cane detection. As far as I'm aware, and I'm guessing R&IB can tell us if it's different, I think we'll be the first company in the world to have done that, because it takes such a lot of resource to be able to get your technology to recognize something as thin as a cane. And if we can do that, I think it'll be a game changer. Honestly, is that we're really good right now. Our obstacle avoidance technology means that our robots don't go near people and things. That's they avoid it. But also, we could just have that extra layer where our robots can say, if they spot a cane, "Hi, I'm a Starship robot. I'm just letting you know that I'm here." I think that'll be really valuable. So for me, that's kind of one of the big priorities for us.
Can you address any sort of regulatory or legal considerations that you've had to address? You said earlier, Lisa, that, you know, obviously you don't just sort of, you know, turn up and open the back of the van and all the robots just kind of rush out into the unsuspecting environment. How does it work? Do you have to kind of have a license to operate them in a certain place? What's the sort of regulatory framework around these delivery robots?
You know, we don't at the moment. It's a real grey area, and it's one of the things that we are constantly calling on government for, because Starship are really responsible about what we do, and we put a lot of resources into community engagement and accessibility and inclusion solutions. Not every company will, and we really need to see regulation around this from the government to ensure that, you know, companies like ours have to. They don't just choose to operate well, but they have to operate well. And that, you know, would be covered by things like a quality impact assessment, which in all honesty, we work with councils really, really closely. We don't just go places and just say, "Tough luck, we're here now." We work with the councils and local authorities before we arrive, and always happily participate in sort of a quality impact assessments, because we're quite comfortable with that, because we have thought about all these things and we have done the right things. But it really needs regulation from national government to make sure that everybody has to do that too.
And how do you see the future of the technology? I occasionally come across articles about how, you know, Amazon are experimenting with drones and stuff like that. Do you think that your robots will always stay on the ground? What's the you know, what's the next big thing in delivery robots? Is it about just getting them out more widely available?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's no plans to give our robots wings as of yet. I think on the ground, we're a certain sort of solution, and we're always going to be part of a multimodal solution that really hits that spot in the last mile of top-up shopping, basically. So our robots are so cautious that you're not likely to see them wandering around in a very busy, sort of near the train station, city centre location, because they're so cautious, they just keep stopping and waiting, and then people would never get their shopping. So in terms of what we do, we're part of a multimodal solution that takes that really carbon intensive, that really expensive last mile of top-up shopping, where you might be only getting a tenner's worth of stuff. It takes that bit of the market where there is a demand and it's really hard to fill with a human. So I think for us, there'll be a whole bunch of stuff around accessibility, but also battery life. One of the big sort of things we're looking at the moment is how can the robots charge themselves when they're out and about? So they don't need to be picked up and taken home for a nap. How do you charge them up? So we've got, we're looking at wireless charging. Again, I think we're the first in the world to do this. The robots will be able to autonomously plug themselves in and charge themselves up, which will be better on carbon emissions, and it'll be better in terms of the number of deliveries that they can do. But I think broadly, there's huge potential, right, in this space, in terms of self-driving generally as well, for people who aren't able to see or who aren't able to drive. Having self-driving vehicles is going to be a game changer, I would think.
And as a leader in this space, what would you say are the most important principles that everybody should be adopting to better accommodate the needs of blind and partially sighted customers?
I think it's important to make it part of your core strategy and not an add-on, which we've done at Starship. We have an entire engineering pipeline that revolves around accessibility. And, you know, I'd say to a business, it's a good thing to do and it's the right thing to do, but there's a huge business need there too, because if you're operating in a community, those are your customers. You want to make people happy that you're there. You don't want to make people upset about it. So it's the right thing to do and it's a business need. But I also think that you can't replicate lived experience. So unless you have people in your team who understand these issues through their own personal experience, you need to set up a mechanism to make sure that that's feeding into what you do. You can't assume you know the answers without listening to people's lived experience.
This has been wonderful, Lisa. Thank you so much for sharing. And we're definitely going to be keeping across this. Really keen to find out more. And definitely looking forward to recording my first experience with a delivery robot at some point. So how can the general public kind of keep up to date? What's the best way to kind of get engaged with Starship Technologies to provide feedback or maybe even come and be part of one of your focus groups?
The RNIB have been great in sort of working with us and telling us what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong. So you can always feed through the RNIB because they sit on our accessibility advisory panel, which is one way to do it. But also just drop us a line on accessibility@starship.co. Always happy to have a chat. Because, you know, obviously we're not in every area yet, but hopefully someday we will be. So having those conversations now for when those things happen is really valuable to us. And social media channels too. We're on X, obviously the former Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn too, and Instagram. And I believe TikTok, although that's probably one for not necessarily my generation, but TikTok we are as well.
Lisa Johnson, Director of Public Affairs at Starship Technologies. Thank you so much for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks, Dave. Lovely to be here.
Now, we love hearing about passions and things that bring people lots of joy. Well, today we're going to be chatting a little bit about gaming and accessible gaming with someone who is absolutely, I would say, obsessed with it. And joining me now is Kyle. It is so nice speaking with you today.
Hello. I'm a bit obsessed with gaming, I would say.
Yeah, it's a bit of a passion of yours, isn't it?
Definitely.
So how did you get into gaming? Would you mind telling us?
I've been doing it for years. Long, long time. Pretty much my whole life I've been gaming. Started with the Nintendo and then moved on to other consoles and even branching into stuff like PC gaming and stuff like that.
You have a visual impairment. Would you mind telling us how does that affect how you game and whether that maybe changed over the years, what games you can play and how you play them?
it doesn't really change what games I play. The only really games that I tend to stay away from are games that are like top-down games, such as like League of Legends and that Ghostbusters game that came out about 10 years ago that was terrible. I tend to keep away from those because they're quite hard to see. Stuff like Hades as well is really hard to see as well. Other than that, I tend to be able to play most games, and I tend to always go in at the very start by not changing any settings. I tend just to go in with the settings at default and see if I can play it. And if I can play it, I keep going. And if I can't, I go in and change stuff like brightness, camera speeds and stuff like that. I go in and change it after I have a go first.
And I feel like it's something that comes up a lot because gaming or accessibility in gaming has become such a hot topic now. You have so many clubs, so many people discovering that they can still game even though maybe their sights adjusting or changing over time. So how are you finding this, I guess, wider, bigger community growing and more people finding the same passion you have?
It's changing, and there's a lot more games coming out that have accessible features. When I started, there wasn't many in the background. Dog's going crazy.
That's okay. So obviously, we're speaking today. You're in your house. If we hear some noise in the background, it's your lovely beagles having a good old play. So you were telling us about how you're finding the new kind of growing community when it comes to gaming and accessibility, and more companies looking more into creating accessible games from the beginning rather than as an afterthought.
It's usually big AAA companies. The one that I can think of, I think, is Insomniac and Naughty Dog are the kind of two that I've seen. Insomniac make the Spider-Man series, which has at this point 3 games, I think. One's due to come out, and I've only played the first, but I have seen like live streams and stuff of the second game, Miles Morales, which has an entire page dedicated to accessible features in the game. The other company behind Last of Us, Uncharted, their go-to when it comes to really good cinematics and stuff as well as accessibility. They tend to make really good stuff, and Insomniac's getting there as well when it comes to those. And those are the general two I've seen that have really good settings. And games like Minecraft as well, they've brought in a lot of settings to allow you to mess with stuff.
You've mentioned quite a few games right now, and I know we get so many releases and it's such a big growing industry, but what if you had to choose one game that you enjoyed the most, maybe just this year, or like one of the latest releases, what would that be?
Oh, there's so many that I've played recently.
Would you like to highlight maybe top two, top three?
I'll highlight the top three. I'm going to say it's a game called, one that I'm playing now, I just played it earlier on today actually, called Earn to Die. It's basically a nice, easy, chill game for the PC. It doesn't require much in the way of playing. It's literally just the arrow keys, and it's one key on the keyboard for boosting while you're driving. And it's basically you just run and shooting. You drive a car, shoot zombies, run zombies over, smash crates. That's basically the game. And it's a lot of fun. Nice, easy to play. Levels take like 15 minutes, so it's quite good fun. Second game, I'm going to have to say it's probably the upcoming Assassin's Creed. It comes out in October, and I'm really looking forward to it. I can't wait for that game to come out. And third game, I'm going to have to say Five Nights at Freddy's. It's October. It's coming out at the end of this month. So I have to say Five Nights at Freddy's, which is on my desk. It's just a fun game, but I have it for the Nintendo Switch, which is another console that I love, but is not as accessible, I would say, as something like the Xbox or the PlayStation, if you're in handheld mode anyway. Screen's not that big if you're in handheld mode, but playing it on the screen is amazing.
What would you like to personally see from the future of the gaming industry? What would you like the bigger companies to maybe do to ensure accessibility, or what would you like to see more of?
I'd like to see them add some more, obviously, visual settings to slow stuff down, in certain things, and a lot of games are starting to do that, like obviously Spider-Man I mentioned, are doing certain things like their sort of QTEs. You can basically just turn a setting off and they're gone, which is really helpful for people who are like a little slower and things like that, which is helpful. I know people are going to moan, but I would like to see more peripherals, more ways of doing it, of playing a game rather than just holding a controller or typing on a keyboard. I would like to see more people be able to do that because it's a lot more fun to use peripherals. I'll go back to Nintendo because Nintendo are a good example of that. So obviously you can get stuff like driving rigs. You can get like a steering wheel for driving games. That's a big one. Flight simulators. But on another level, Nintendo do a lot of different stuff where it's stuff like the Joy-Cons, for example. You can take Joy-Cons off the Switch, And you can play them like Mario Party. You can put them on like the Ring Fit Adventure. And Nintendo have done a lot of that in the past, where it's like instead of having just a remote, you can put that remote like in a gun and play a shooting game. Or you can put it in a tennis racket and play tennis. Those are a lot more fun because you can feel it. You're not guessing with the remote.
What would you say to someone who is maybe has recently gone through sight loss, or maybe they've had some changes in their vision in recent months and they feel like they can't really game?
Just pick a game, go into any kind of, you know, like the secondhand shops or whatever, and just have a go. There is always ways. Xbox has plenty of settings, including like a text-to-speech just built in. It has Zoom built in. It helps if you have a big monitor because it allows everything on the screen to, by default, to be larger. And just tweaking the settings until you feel you can play the game. A lot of them have easy modes or sort of adventure modes or whatever. You're not having to do something too quick or too intense.
Well, Kyle, thank you so much for speaking with us today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Yeah, thank you for letting me come on and talk rubbish about video games, because it's a lot of fun.
If you have a technology question, why not ask the Tech Talk team? Email now, techtalk@rnib.org.uk, or tweet at RNIB Radio using the hashtag AskTechTalk.
We have had an email come flooding in from David responding to our retrospective. Do you remember a couple of weeks ago we were talking about technology from the past? Well, David says he remembers his Apple II from the 1980s, particularly liked the Deck Talk speech on that one. Also remembers having a Braille Pocket from the American Printing House and the Braille Light in the 1990s. I remember the Braille Light. Well, good to hear from you, David, and he's enjoying the show. Well, David said he tried the Braille Sense from HIMSS but didn't get on with it.
Yeah, I remember using the Braille Sense U2. That was that takes me back to my school days. So I guess that shows my age. I quite liked it. I wouldn't use it nowadays, to be honest, but my favourite feature about it, and this is terrible, this maybe explains a lot, but my favourite feature about it was that it only had that tiny little LCD display, but obviously a really big, was it 32-cell Braille display? And of course it connected to your iPhone. So I got away with quite a bit in terms of using my phone in lessons. I don't advise it. That is not, don't try that at home or at school, but yeah, that was one of my reasons for liking it.
Do you know, last week when the new Beatles single came out, I have to confess, I might have had a little listen to that just on my earphones while I was pretending to work. Hubert, Braille note takers, is that your thing?
I've never actually used one, to be honest. I think I had a go at one of them when I was learning Braille, because I started learning Braille quite late. One of the devices I was using more is like your old school Perkins Braillers, but not really had much experience of Braille note takers. And then my next experience of Braille tech was what we've talked about a few months ago, was the Habel 1.
Well, I have a Braille Sense, and I do like it. And the main reason I like it is the integration with OneDrive. So I can write something on there, save it in OneDrive, go on my laptop and it's there, and the other way around as well. So that OneDrive integration works really well for me in a work context. Good to hear from you, David. If anyone else has got any thoughts about technology from yesteryear, do let us know. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Hubert, Callum, thanks a lot.
You are listening to RNIB Connect Radio. Now, we've discussed outdoor navigation many times here on Tech Talk. However, what about indoor navigation? How do you manage that complex environment? Well, my guest today, back again, Neil Barnfather, Chief Commercial Officer at GoodMaps, hopefully can answer some of these questions. Neil, welcome to Tech Talk.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to return and talk about this topic. So we are here to talk about Goodmaps Explore, the Explore flagship product from Goodmaps. And the question I have first is, Neil, how does it work? How does Explore aid with indoor navigation for blind and partially sighted users?
So in essence, we're all very familiar with outdoor navigation products. They'll provide turn-by-turn navigation and ultimately, hopefully, get you to the building you were looking for. And then sort of, you know, that euphemistic, you have arrived. But the reality of that statement is you haven't arrived. You're at the structure, but you wanted something inside. And that's really what Goodmaps, as a fundamental purpose for its existence, aims to solve. The ability to help our community enter a venue where traditional GPS signals won't penetrate the structure, so we can't use a GPS system, and we aim to take someone who is from our community who has no familiarity with the location, so all they have is their O&M skills and O&M tools, be that a guide dog or a cane, and we will navigate them with real-time, turn-by-turn navigational prompts, so walk forwards 10 meters, turn left, and so forth, around that location. It's obviously more than simple turn-by-turn navigation. What we're also giving you access to is a directory, so you can understand what's in the building, an ability to search the venue, and so forth. So realistically, it's what you get outside that really has been the hindrance for helping us as a community in accessing the indoors. Historically, we are attempting to remedy that problem and help blind and low vision people actually get around those spaces, be that a retail store, be that a shopping mall, be that a train station, airport, an office building, a hospital, and so forth.
What has particularly inspired the creation of the Goodmaps Explore app?
You have to go back to 2018-19, and the American Printing House for the Blind, APH, challenged its internal innovation team and said, you know, come on, guys, it's 2018. How can it be that, you know, people who are blind and low vision cannot, you know, access a building when they've had no prior training or awareness of that location? You know, they've got their guide dog, they've got their cane. You know, in theory, if we gave them access to some form of support and aid in that spot, they should be able to do it. And look at really all of the societal barriers that could be enhanced and broken down a little bit by doing that. You know, if I can access a hospital, you know, then I can suddenly have better access to my healthcare. If I can go for a train station or an airport, I can go places, whether that's to work or whether that's on leisure or so forth. You know, if I can access a university campus, I can now have better access to education opportunities. And importantly, if I can access an office environment, that equally helps break down some of those barriers. So really, it was all about that. The app, if effectively this had been tried before, right? You know, we'd had Bluetooth beaconing, Wi-Fi fingerprinting, and all sorts of technologies that had sort of almost had the cusp of that promise of doing this, but ultimately failed because Bluetooth as a technology isn't accurate enough. There's a lot of expensive deployments, same with Wi-Fi fingerprinting. So there's a lot of challenges in doing that, let alone, you know, as the world moves ever closer towards thinking about sustainability and the impact of what we're doing, whacking in a dozen Bluetooth beacons, you know, plastic and circuit boards and so forth, copper wiring, just isn't what was wanted and what should be done. So APH's criteria pretty much surrounded, it has to be accurate enough for someone who's totally blind, it has to be simplistic to use, and importantly, no infrastructure. So, you know, whether you look at that from a sustainability point of view, or whether you look at it from the point of view of making sure the venue doesn't have any significant barriers to putting it in, those were the sorts of targets that had to be met. And that's really where the innovation team actually sort of were able to sit down and say, you know, if we combine these two technologies, which in this case are LiDAR, which is using effectively lasers to scan and create a three-dimensional representation of the space, and then what we have coined as camera positioning system, So this is using the camera on the phone along with the other internal sensors on the device to compare and contrast that, what the camera can see, against the original scan that we took of a venue. Effectively, that's what the end user's doing. They're showing the rear-facing camera on their device, the environment. The app is able to determine where you are. And then from that, as you can imagine, if we know where you are and which way you're facing, we can provide you with navigational prompts. And that's what we're doing. We're helping people navigate with that real-time, term by term, so that the familiar experience that you have outdoors now is available in what actually are very complex to navigate spaces, such as train stations and things.
Now, you've mentioned accuracy in your answer about the indoor navigation system that Explore uses. So tell us more, how accurate is that indoor navigation? How accurate are the directions?
So we will tell you that in an optimum conditions, we are as accurate currently as up to 1 meter of accuracy. And you know, that's obviously an optimum conditions. So what does that really mean for me as someone who's a guide dog user or a long cane user when I'm actually in an environment? If one imagines walking through a supermarket, that is good enough to be told, you know, you're walking along the central aisle of the supermarket, looking for aisle number 20, and that turn left instruction, you know, supermarket aisles are approximately 3 meters wide. That is good enough to get you with a left turn at the point of the aisle. If you take that in a train station context, that is the sort of thing that'll let you, I mean, when I walk around London Euston using the app, I will be guided to say, for example, an escalator, and the app is pretty much getting you slap bang to the bottom of or top of the escalator and getting you there. You know, that's an incredible level of sophistication and support that is providing. Obviously very contingent on robust, well-trained, well-maintained O&M skills, but ultimately it's hitting that mark.
How does Good Maps Explore handle different types of indoor environments?
So the fundamental principles don't change. We have a forwards, turn left, turn right, slight left and slight right command currently. We are exploring in the future, increasing that sensitivity, but we're always very conscious that, you know, you want to make sure that there's a degree of, you know, the end user receiving and understanding what's required. In terms of different environments, I think most, I would generally break it down into a retail environment contains lots of 90 degree turns. You know, you're sort of walking along an aisle and then you get to the end of the aisle and you've got to make a left or a right or go straight ahead and so forth. That's very similar to a hospital or to an office building or, you know, certain types of museums and other things. So they really fit into that space. Where it gets interesting is things like railway station concourses or very, very large open expanses. And, you know, whilst we're still using those left, right, forwards, slight left, slight rights, what we're able to do is nudge you, you know, using those commands back into a straight line. So even when I walk through Birmingham New Street Station, very, very expansive open concourse, which is extremely, you know, if you put a blind person on that and said, right, go forwards, we are going to drift. There's no doubt about it. But the app is able to determine that you're drifting and nudge you back into the right spot with a slight right, slight left. And that's really partly what that command's there for. So I would break environments down into those sorts of, you know, is there lots of 90 degree turns? So, you know, your supermarkets, your shopping malls, your, you know, office buildings, hospitals and so forth, versus lots of open air spaces. And What we can also do is lay down what we call routing lines. So these are the sort of main thoroughfares we want you to stay to, or that we think are most suitable based on the type of environment. And again, a railway station concourse is a classic example. So if you look at, say, London Euston, for example, there's what Network Rail would call the dwell area, which is the sort of main centre of the concourse. Lots and lots of people standing, looking up at display boards. It never makes sense, even though you can walk through the middle of it, it doesn't make sense to have someone who's a guide dog user ploughing through the middle of 4,000 people standing, looking up at a notice board. So what we do is we put our routing lines that are favourable, and that so we're able to provide a priority, a preference to those lines, and we route you round the perimeter of the concourse. And whilst, you know, that might add 30 seconds, 45 seconds to the route, what it does do, though, is keep you much more in a flow of the movement of people, rather than sort of, oh, sorry, as you're ploughing through, you know, 3,000 people who aren't even looking where they're going. It is quite important to stress, we do not take you round what you might consider an obstruction or what have you. So, you know, this is not replacing your O&M skills. So if we're guiding you along a supermarket aisle, for example, and we're telling you, you know, go down this aisle all the way to the end and right. If someone has left their trolley in the middle of the aisle or is standing, you know, picking up a box of cornflakes, for example, you are still using your guide dog or your long cane to navigate those obstructions. The you know, proceed straight 30 meter command is valid, but you obviously may need to sidestep things. It depends on the environment. Obviously, office buildings tend not to have that sort of problem going on. You know, but if you take a railway station, for example, they're immensely busy. You know, a lot of people not paying attention to what they're doing. So that specifically is why we have not only our routing lines, but we very carefully consider and then monitor how effective those are. And we're able to, as I say, produce preferences and even weight, what we call weightings on them. And we can make routes less favorable and more desirable and on a sort of sliding scale. So it's really beneficial to be able to help get you in a space that's more sensible, perhaps you might say, and gonna help really support you in getting where you need to go.
We come to the end of another Tech Talk. Thank you so much for your company. We really appreciate it. Do tune in next time when we'll be hearing part two of that interview with Neil Barnfather from Good Maps, and also catching up with what's new at Site Village Southeast. And that's it. From myself, Dave Williams, and Callum Stoneman and Hubert Pavalkovich.
Bye for now.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.